So the Times believes a 14-year-old who was merely born here but raised entirely in Mexico is an American. But a 14-year-old born in Mexico and raised in the United States is also an American, a dreamer. Show me the reasoning behind that, other than, we want as many Mexicans voting here as we can get. Headless body found in borderless country. I take it that liberals would be dismayed if Mexicans began beheading people in America, based on their relentless mocking of Arizona Governor Jan Brewer's claim, in July 2010, that there had been beheadings in the Arizona desert. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank sneered, "Ay, caramba! Those dark-skinned foreigners are now severing the heads of fair-haired Americans? Maybe they're also scalping them, or shrinking them, or putting them on a spike." Salon.com cited Brewer's remark to say, "As you can see, Jan Brewer is crazy." Apparently, liberals considered it pretty far-fetched that Mexican cartel violence would ever in a million years cross into America. So if it did, that would be a big deal, right? 3 months after Brewer's claim, Mexicans beheaded a man in Arizona. Within the next 2 years, a headless body turned up in the Arizona desert, and the dismembered body of a 19-year-old American girl was found in Oklahoma. All three dismemberments were believed to be the work of Mexican cartels, confirmed in the first Arizona case. At that point, liberals' position was that it was no big deal after all. In fact, Mexicans beheading people in the United States was of such utter insignificance that the media barely mentioned these beheadings and went back to the eye-rolling retort, "Show me a fence, I'll show you a ladder." The Mexican predilection for beheadings is not limited to drug cartels. In 2004, two Mexican men decapitated three children, ages 9 to 10, in Baltimore, Maryland, over some obscure family dispute. Everyone involved was an illegal alien, all related to one another through a series of connections that would require a Talmudic scholar to sort out, but seemed to involve a lot of baby mamas. According to the Mexican government, the executioners, Policarpio Espinosa and Adán Espinosa Canela, were the children's uncle and cousin, respectively, and the three parents were Ricardo Espinosa, Mimi Quesada, and Maria Andrea Espejo. One child was completely decapitated, the other two partially decapitated. Even seasoned police officers were shaken by the grisly crime scene. If Muslim men had decapitated three Syrian children in Baltimore, do you think you would have heard about it? The Baltimore Sun tidied up the executions, calling them slashing deaths. How about the slashing death of James Foley at the hands of ISIS? Some Mexicans practice Palo Mayombe, a primitive voodoo religion found throughout Latin America that holds that human sacrifice brings magical powers. The upside to their belief system is that practitioners will confess right away to committing heinous dismemberments because they believe they are invisible. Americans in New Jersey and Texas have been dismembered by the cult. Is an American citizen more likely to be murdered by a Muslim terrorist or by a Mexican? According to CNN, 29 Americans have been killed in Islamic terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11. I don't know why they excluded 9/11, so by my count, it's 3,029. In fact, let's round it up to 4,000 to cover the last several decades. According to the GAO's extremely conservative figures, Mexicans alone, forget other immigrants, have murdered a minimum of 23,000 Americans in the last few decades. Who's wrong, us or Israel? If this were happening in Israel, forget offense, Netanyahu would be bombing Mexico. Instead of prosecuting border guards who shoot and wound illegal aliens, as President Bush did, Netanyahu would stoutly defend the agents, saying we didn't choose this. And if the agents killed any illegals, he'd dismiss the casualties as telegenically dead Mexicans. If this country were Israel, 80% of the country would be cheering a military offensive on our southern border. HBO's Bill Maher would be saying of our southern neighbors, Americans have 349 Nobel Prizes. Latin Americans have 16. That seems like kind of a big advantage for Team America. It's worse than that. Excluding the humanities prizes, all of South and Central America combined, with a population of nearly 450 million, have won only 5 Nobel Prizes, compared with well over 300 Nobel Prizes in the sciences for Americans. Marr would place the blame for violence on the border on illegal aliens themselves, saying, "If it's your father, your brother, your uncle, who's smuggling drugs, guns, humans, and counterfeit goods into the United States, whose fault is it really? Do you really expect Americans not to retaliate?" Howard Stern would denounce radio callers bleating about the alleged humanitarian crisis on our border, explaining, "The median income in the United States is $29,000, and the Mexican median income is $3,000. But the Mexicans are mad at the United States, instead of being mad at the effing drug cartels running their so-called country, who are raping the country, taking all the aid that the United States actually gives to them. That they're not angry with. They're angry at the U.S. He'd point out that the United States and Canada are the only real democracies on the continent. Erupting in a volcano of expletives, he would say, "Americans get enough f*** all over the world. They get f*** on all the time. We won the Mexican-American War in 1848. We are the indigenous people of that area. I'm sick of the bull b***." The above actually was said, but it was said about Israel and the Palestinians, not the United States and Mexicans. The harm done to the United States by Mexicans is considerably greater than the harm done to Israelis by the ineffectual Palestinians. In the July 2014 conflict, Palestinians fired more than 4,000 rockets into Israel. In all, their bombs killed 6 civilians, including one Thai national. Barrages of rockets from Gaza, the New York Times reported, do little damage because Palestinians are using largely futile homemade rockets. Americans are always asked, "What would you do if rockets were being fired from Mexico into Texas?" The answer is, absolutely nothing. My question is, what if instead of a few thousand Palestinian criminals in Israel, Palestinians were committing hundreds of thousands of crimes against Israelis? Murder, rape, drug trafficking, violent assaults, robbery, drunk driving homicides, and burglary. That's the equivalent of the minimum number of immigrants committing crimes in large parts of America. The U.S. government admits that at least 351,000 criminal immigrants were incarcerated in the United States as of 2011, the vast majority of them Mexican. According to the GAO, 5 jurisdictions alone, New York City, Los Angeles County, Orange County, California, Harris County, Texas, and Maricopa County, Arizona, are incarcerating more than 110,000 criminal aliens. The total population of those 5 counties is 28 million, or about 3.5 times the size of Israel. The illegal alien crime wave in those parts of America, therefore, would be the same as 30,000 Palestinians, Jordanians, and Eritreans in Israeli prisons. In fact, however, in 2012, Israel was incarcerating a total of only 18,000 prisoners of any type. The GAO also reports that each arrested illegal alien had committed an average of 12 offenses, or 1.32 million crimes in those 5 jurisdictions. Illegal immigrants' most common offense was drug trafficking, except in New York, where it was murder. Based on the GAO's estimate of offense types committed by criminal aliens, that would amount to approximately 2,750 drug arrests of immigrants in Israel, 5,500 motor vehicle violations, 2,750 assaults, 800 rapes, and 400 murders. In fact, there were only 124 murders in Israel in the first 11 months of 2013, according to the U.S. State Department. And remember, the GAO was only counting illegal aliens. We have no idea how many legal immigrants, anchor babies, refugees, asylees, and naturalized citizens were incarcerated in these 5 counties. Is it good for the Americans? If Israel had our open border policies, it would be overrun with foreign criminals. If we had their policies, the only criminals in America would be the guys you see on Cops. There would be about 700,000 people in American prisons instead of 2 million. Jews forthrightly ask, is it good for the Jews? Why can't Americans ask, is it good for Americans? We're the only nation on earth that specifically seeks out immigrants whom we have to help. even those who commit heinous crimes against us. How about asking our politicians, who's wrong, us or Israel? Chuck Schumer? Marco? Governor Christie? Hey, where'd everybody go? If any American politician thinks Israel is pursuing an inhumane immigration policy, America has the influence to stop it. I happen to think Israel's policy is perfectly sensible. But Democrats don't. Rick Perry doesn't. Jeb Bush doesn't. Like Israel, we reached a two-state solution with our neighbor, but Mexico refuses to accept that settlement. Our boundary with Mexico was established in 1848. Israel's boundaries with the Palestinians were first established in 1948 and modified in 1967. Our neighbors are at least as troublesome as Israel's, but instead of lobbing impotent rockets across the border, they commit murder, child rape, vehicular homicide, narcotics crimes, assault, and arson in this country on a staggering scale. Far more Americans are murdered by Mexicans per capita than Israelis are murdered by Palestinians. Could we move Israel to our southern border? They know how to defend the country. Spot the Immigrant. Case number 1. Fresno, California. Let's play Spot the Immigrant. In 1998, three adolescent girls in Fresno ran away from home, then changed their minds when they had gotten about 30 miles away. They called an acquaintance to pick them up, and on the way back, he stopped to see a friend at a motel. When the girls entered the motel room with him, they were seized by 24 men, ranging in age from 14 to 45, who proceeded to gang rape the girls over the next several hours. Now, try to guess the ethnicity and immigration status of the perpetrators, based on these representative excerpts from a single New York Times article on the gang rape. New York Times, May 1, 1998. Gang rape of three girls leaves Fresno shaken and questioning, by Don Terry. Fresno, California, April 27th. On the edge of this working-class city, along a highway not far from the vineyards and the strawberry and cotton fields, on some of the richest farmland in the nation, as many as 20 men and boys crowded into a motel room 3 weeks ago for what police said was a night of rape. The setting, working-class farmland. Maybe the rapists were farmers. Back to Terry. What happened on the night of April 6 has shaken many people in this central California city of 450,000 residents. But Fresno lost its small-town innocence years ago in what the current mayor, Jim Patterson, called an explosion of crime. I wonder what happened years ago to account for Fresno's loss of small-town innocence and explosion in crime. Terry again. Everybody is hurt by this, said Mayor Patterson. This is one of those god-awful things that could stigmatize a community. The rapists must be longtime Fresno residents for the attack to stigmatize a community. Terry. The authorities kept the attack quiet for 2 weeks while they investigated and tracked down suspects. But over the last several days, as the arrest began, the assault has been front-page news here. The rapists are probably part of the old boys' network. Otherwise, why would the police keep the case so hush-hush? Terry again. Last Friday, a 24-year-old man was picked up at his home, and a teenager was taken into custody at his high school, bringing the total under arrest in the attack to 5 adults, the oldest 31, and 7 juveniles. The police are hunting for 3 to 5 more suspects. So we know the rapists included a man, adults, and some juveniles. They must have had no other relevant identifying characteristics, such as football players or members of the Rotary Club. Terry again. We've had gang rapes occur before, but not of this magnitude, said Lieutenant Jerry Davis, the commander of the city's Crimes Against Persons Unit. The crime itself is bad enough, but this was directed at children. It's mind-boggling. The police's minds are boggled. The rapists must be boy-next-door types. Terry, a rally is planned on Friday at California State University here to show support for the girls and to demonstrate to the community that this could be your daughter, that this could happen to any of us, said Catherine Forbes, a lecturer of women's studies at the university. This could happen to your daughter. The rapists are definitely plain vanilla Americans. Terry, but everyone from Fresno's mayor to rape counselors agree that what happened here could happen anywhere, perhaps in a fraternity house, or in a basement in a predominantly white suburb like Glen Ridge, New Jersey, where a group of high school football players sexually assaulted a mentally retarded teenage girl with a bat and a stick in 1989. Wait, why are we talking about a fraternity gang rape? And how did a decade-old sexual assault of a mentally disabled girl in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, come into this? Was the Duke lacrosse team involved? Back to Terry. Bernard Lefkowitz, who wrote a book about the assault in Glen Ridge, our guys said, "For a lot of boys, acting abusively toward women is regarded as a rite of passage. It's woven into our culture." For some reason, The Times is going on an extended exegesis about a freakishly rare sexual assault on a mentally handicapped girl in another state from the 1980s. It was sick, but it was more of an abuse of the mentally disabled case than a rape case, since the girl, who was their age, didn't object. Terry, woven into Fresno's subculture are gangs, and the police report on the attack linked some suspects with one called the Mongolian Boys Society. There are a multitude of ethnic gangs here, including a white supremacist gang called the Peckerwoods. Why is The Times talking about a white supremacist gang? Is the Mongolian Boys Society a white supremacist gang? Terry. Martha Moreno, 13, said she had not been surprised by what happened because too many boys think girls are their slaves. "It really scared me when I heard about what happened," she said. "It makes you think anything can happen to you. But I still tell boys I'm not a slave." I have no idea what that little vignette illustrates, but neither the victims of this gang rape nor their assailants had names like Martha Moreno. The surprise ending, which Times readers would never be told, was that the Fresno gang rapists were Hmong immigrants, as were their victims. Over the next year, about 36 Hmong men were indicted for a series of gang rapes and forced prostitution of young girls in the Fresno area, including the gang rape that reminded the Times of high school football players in New Jersey a decade earlier. Apart from a random reference to the Mongolian Boys Society, the only hint that the Fresno gang rape was entirely an immigrant affair was this passage. Ms. Eager, the director of the Fresno Rape Center, said people had called her office asking if the girls had been wearing sexy clothing or if they'd done something to provoke the attack. One man called to say that because the girls had walked into the motel room, it was not fair to call it rape. Only on Lifetime TV for Women would an American man call the prosecutor to ask if child victims of a gang rape were wearing sexy clothing. Why does the public have to search for clues in a news story? News is not supposed to be a suspense novel. The Times knew, so why not tell us? Instead, it deliberately hid the truth by launching into a pointless reverie about a 1989 rape in Glen Ridge, nonspecific fraternity rapes, and a white supremacist gang in Fresno. Never did The Times inform its readers that the Fresno gang rape was committed by Hmong, nor did The Times provide the names of the suspected rapists. Not through their arrests, indictments, pleas, and convictions. Everyone else was named. Law enforcement officials, the mayor, rape crisis counselors. Why not the perps? The media would sooner publish the names of rape victims than the names of their diverse rapists. Gang rape is a strength. Wait, did I get that right? Eventually, 23 Hmong were indicted in the Fresno child rape, which sounds kind of newsworthy to me. But only two newspapers and one TV network informed the public that the rapists were Hmong: the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Minnesota, the Washington Post, and CNN. Why would a newspaper in Minnesota report on a gang rape in California, you ask? Only someone in the news business could be expected to notice. But a rape epidemic has been sweeping through all the Hmong hotspots in America: Fresno, California, St. Paul, Minnesota, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Boulder, Colorado, and Detroit, Michigan. And that's to say nothing of the sudden appearance of polygamy, opium use and animal sacrifice. After another Hmong rape in Fresno, the Times sympathetically explained that in Hmong culture, no means yes. In that case, a 23-year-old Hmong man kidnapped a co-ed from her dorm room, took her to his parents' house, and raped her. Oozing with cultural understanding, the Times noted that this was how Hmong proposed marriage. How does a woman decline the offer? Hang herself? According to a lawyer quoted by the Times, the American witnesses to the girl's abduction had simply misunderstood her ritual protests and called the police. Apparently, the rape victim didn't understand either, inasmuch as she filed rape charges. The Times article about the rape was titled, "Asian Tradition at War with American Laws." A few years after that, in 1988, a Hmong immigrant kidnapped a young Laotian woman from her Fresno office and forcibly raped her. The American judge sentenced the rapist to only 120 days in jail after his lawyer said that, in Hmong culture, if a woman doesn't fight her rapist with sufficient ferocity, the rapist and victim are considered married. Note to Hmong, you might want to put this on your Match.com profile. In 1991, Hmong immigrants in Colorado purchased a 15-year-old girl from her Hmong parents in Fresno for $8,300, not including shipping. The girl was taken to Colorado, where she was sexually assaulted by the family's 21-year-old son. "Happy birthday, son." She escaped by slipping a note to a neighbor that read, "I'm not his wife. They forced me here, and I want to go back to Fresno." You know someone's being held prisoner if they voluntarily return to Fresno. When the police showed up, the Colorado Hmong were indignant, saying they had paid good money for the girl, and announcing that the purchase of teenaged brides was a custom among members of their ethnic group. In 1996, it was multicultural fantasy camp when Dominican immigrant Judge Ramona Gonzalez presided over the criminal trial of Hmong immigrant Sia Yavang. Convicted of sexually molesting his stepdaughters, aged 10 and 11, Vang faced up to 80 years in prison. Instead, Judge Gonzalez sentenced him to English lessons. Perhaps she'd found a new treatment for sex offenders. You need a new hobby. How about learning English? Do you think that will help stop these cravings, Doc? It's worth a try. The child molester's lawyer had argued that sex with girls is accepted in Vietnam, the defendant's native country. Had I been there, I would have pointed out, we're not in Vietnam. In 1999, 9 Hmong men pleaded guilty to luring 4 teen and preteen girls from Wisconsin to Detroit, where the girls were held captive and repeatedly gang-raped. In 2003, a group of Hmong men took turns raping young girls, quote, to see whether their small bodies were large enough to accommodate adult customers. In November 2011, a Hmong woman helped a Hmong man rape a 16-year-old girl with a beer can, brutalizing the girl so badly that her blood soaked through 2 blankets and a carpet. The unconscious girl had to be airlifted to the Mayo Medical Clinic. Thank you, Teddy Kennedy. The prosecution of Hmong rapists is hindered by the fact that neither the girls nor their families are inclined to report the rapes. Rolling Stone magazine might want to look into this. The Associated Press reports, in Hmong culture, a girl who loses her virginity before marriage may be looked down upon by her own relatives, even if she is forcibly raped. Do tell me more about these colorful, fascinating people. Around the time of the Hmong rape in Fresno that made the Times think of fraternity rapes, Hmong armed burglars in St. Paul forced a Hmong woman to strip naked, then fondled her in front of her husband and 9 children. They robbed the family and, before leaving, raped the mother and her 11-year-old daughter. According to Hmong cultural anthropologists, the assailants believed that the sexual assaults would prevent the family from reporting the robbery. In fact, the family reported the robbery right away, but waited days to mention the rapes. In November 2011, a 15-year-old Hmong girl was gang-raped after a Hmong friend offered to give her a ride home from school, but instead took her to an abandoned house where about 24 Hmong men and boys were waiting. The men dragged the girl, kicking and screaming, from the car and gang-raped her. She didn't report the crime because of the shame to her family. Eventually, school officials discovered the attack and called the police. After a 12-year-old Hmong girl in Minnesota was gang-raped by at least 10 men, neither she nor her family told the police. Over the next several weeks, she continued to be abducted and gang-raped. Returning home after one brutal episode, limping in pain, a female relative said to her, "You're just a little slut." A 14-year-old Hmong girl who was gang-raped in 1998 reports that her Hmong classmates look at me like I'm just a tramp. A 16-year-old Hmong girl who was gang-raped and forced into prostitution by some Hmong men never told her parents about it, explaining that her mother would only say, "You deserved it." Like I haven't heard that before. This exact episode has appeared on Law & Order dozens of times, but the rapists were always preppy fraternity guys. When a disturbed young girl at the University of Virginia tells three different stories about being gang-raped at a fraternity house, her story is scooped up by Rolling Stone magazine and becomes major national news. But an actual gang-rape epidemic sweeping California, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin is deliberately hidden from the public. You can't make a governing Democratic coalition without breaking a few girls. Even if the press were dying to report on the Hmong gang rape spree, the police won't tell them about it. A year before the Hmong gang rape that reminded the Times of a rape in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, the police in St. Paul issued a warning about gang rapists using telephone chat lines to lure girls out of their homes. Although the warning was issued only in Hmong, St. Paul's Police Department refused to confirm to the St. Paul Pioneer Press that the suspects were Hmong, finally coughing up only the information that they were Asian. And the gang rapes continue. The Star Tribune counted nearly 100 Hmong males charged with rape or forced prostitution from 2000 to June 30, 2005. More than 80% of the victims were 15 or younger. A quarter of their victims were not Hmong. The police say many more Hmong rapists have gone unpunished. They have no idea how many, because Hmong refuse to report rape. Reporters aren't inclined to push the issue. The only rapes that interest the media are apocryphal gang rapes committed by white men. Was America short on Hmong? These Backward Hill people began pouring into the United States in the 70s as a reward for their help during the ill-fated Vietnam War. That war ended 40 years ago, but the United States is still taking in thousands of Hmong, quote, refugees every year, so taxpayers can spend millions of dollars on English language and cultural assimilation classes, public housing, food stamps, health care, prosecutors, and prisons to accommodate all the child rapists. By now, there are an estimated 273,000 Hmong in the United States. Canada only has about 800. Did America lose a bet? In the last few decades, America has taken in more Hmong than Czechs, Danes, French, Luxembourgers, New Zealanders, Norwegians, or Swiss. We have no room for them. We need to make room for a culture where child rape is the norm. A foreign gang rape culture that blames 12-year-old girls for their own rapes may not be a good fit with American culture, especially now that political correctness prevents us from criticizing any minority group. At least when white males commit a gang rape, the media never shut up about it. The Glen Ridge gang rape occurred more than a quarter century ago, and the Times still thinks the case hasn't been adequately covered. The witch doctor is in. If liberals will excuse rape when committed by immigrants, it's the work of a moment for them to drop their reverence for science when it conflicts with primitive beliefs of tribal people transplanted to the United States. A Fresno man was horrified when he looked out his window and saw his Hmong neighbors clubbing a German Shepherd puppy to death. The police arrived and found out the Hmong were practicing a ritual slaughter to appease the gods, because the woman of the house was sick, all of which was reported with great sensitivity by the Los Angeles Times. True, an American doctor had told the woman that she just had diabetes, but as the Times reported, she isn't so sure. An American doctor said she had diabetes. She had diabetes. Is that really an open question at the LA Times? Other Hmong in California weren't so sure when American doctors told them their kids had measles, club feet, and even cancer, deferring instead to their ancient folkways over the white man's science. As a result, at least 9 Hmong children died of measles in a single year. 1 Hmong was condemned to live with club feet, and a Hmong girl with ovarian cancer suddenly disappeared, never receiving the chemotherapy she needed. It was the gods' punishment for an ancestor's evil ways. The LA Times was practically lactating with cultural understanding about the Hmong's canine murder, titling the article, "Hmong Sacrifice of Puppy Reopens Cultural Wounds." It seems that Americans were creating cultural wounds by complaining about the Hmong clubbing Fido to death. How about the puppy's wounds? Could we get an article on that? Hello, PETA? Stop hassling that kid for eating a hamburger. I got a real story for you. When even animal rights activists abandon their concern for helpless creatures out of political correctness toward immigrants, the brainwashing has reached a crisis point. Instead of criticizing the Hmong house pet Holocaust, the head of Fresno's Humane Society, Don Pugh, called Americans racist for objecting to it. Pugh told the LA Times that he got more calls about animal sacrifice than he found animal carcasses. Thus, he concluded, complaints about Hmong clubbing dogs to death was, quote, racism pure and simple. On Pugh's logic, Jimmy Hoffa is still alive. Notwithstanding Pugh's searing analysis, it is a fact that Hmong ritually sacrifice animals. They brag about it. They demand First Amendment protection for it. They submit court documents requesting victim restitution payments for their animal sacrifices. The Hmong shaman who killed the German Shepherd puppy, for example, boasted to the LA Times that he sacrifices animals every year to release the souls of the animals who helped him during the year so that they can be reborn. The husband of the diabetic Hmong woman demanded to know what else they were supposed to do. "We burned the paper money," he said, casually admitting to another crime. "We did the chicken and the pig, but still my wife gets no better. What was I to do? I am a shaman, and this is what we believe. So I bought the dog for $5 and did the ceremony right here." No word on whether plans mandated by Obamacare cover animal sacrifice. After a Hmong was stabbed by a Minnesota man, probably driven mad by seeing a puppy clubbed to death, he submitted a victim restitution statement to the court requesting repayment for cow sacrifice for a Hugh Plig ceremony, $540. Pig sacrifice for Hugh Plig ceremony, $90. 2 chickens for sacrifice for Hugh Plig ceremony, $10. Roast pig for Hugh Plig ceremony, $155.15. Shell woman to conduct Hugh Plig ceremony, $200. The Hmong's legal filings explained that animal sacrifices are necessary to, quote, restore the soul of a victim. This is contained in an official court record in the United States of America. And the trial court approved most of it, ruling only that the 2 chickens were, quote, excessive. The American assailant ordered to pay for this insane hokum appealed on Establishment Clause grounds. He lost. The Minnesota Supreme Court upheld victim restitution expenses for an animal sacrifice. But the Humane Society's Don Pugh says the idea that Hmong engage in animal sacrifice is racism, pure and simple. After Minnesota experienced a rash of Hmong gang rapes, animal sacrifices, and one-child murder, as well as a particularly shocking mass murder of Minnesota hunters, a local talk radio host suggested that Hmong either assimilate or hit the road. The Baltimore Sun somberly reported his, quote, hateful words, adding with sadness that no one had ever dared to blurt out such sentiments publicly. What is the formal book writing equivalent of, "Are you f***ing kidding me?" When a proposal that tribal Laotians living in Minnesota temper their enthusiasm for mass murder, child rape, and puppy killing is treated like something out of Mein Kampf, the country may be a few tweaks away from a serious effort at assimilation. In 1987, a Hmong father and son beat the crap out of 23-year-old Michael Spiropoulos in a road rage incident in Chicago. As Spiropoulos approached their car, Bravo Shong, 38, leapt out and began hitting him on the head with a steel bar. Bravo's father, Ching, joined in, holding Spiropoulos in a bear hug so that the son could continue the attack. At trial, the Hmong men testified that it was Spiropoulos who had dragged Bravo from his car and beaten him. All witnesses contradicted their account, as did Spiropoulos's hospital records. Unfortunately, we can't expect Hmong to tell the truth, unless everybody in the courtroom drinks rooster blood first. This the Hmong defendants requested in their court papers. It seems these vibrant people believe that a person who lies after drinking rooster blood will die within a year, and the rooster will take the person's spirit, preventing the liar from being reincarnated as a human. So at least there's solid science behind it. Although the judge ruled against drinking rooster blood, he imposed no punishment on the Hmong for a vicious assault that sent an American to the hospital, instead ordering them to take English lessons and a class in cultural assimilation. People who never should have been in America in the first place get affirmative action in jobs, in college admissions, in newspaper coverage of their crimes, and in actual criminal sentencing. We used to have equality before the law. We used to have Western medicine. We used to have colorblind aspirations. But now we have third world immigrants. Chapter 9. Public warned to be on lookout for man. Gang rape, child rape, incest, it's been a long time since we've seen much of that in the United States. Of course, there are lots of things we thought had been abolished 100 years ago that our mass immigration policies are bringing back. Every society has monsters, but why are we importing primitive cultures that are centuries behind the West in their regard for women and children? When it comes to multiculturalism, you can't say, "We love the empanadas, but we don't want 40-year-old men raping their nieces." You don't get to choose. This is not a buffet. It's sheer madness for a first-world country with unprecedented freedoms for women to be welcoming cultures with medieval views on the sexes. A nation's culture consists of the habits of its people. In the groundbreaking book Albion Seed, Four British Folkways in America, historian David Hackett Fisher illustrates how hardwired a people's culture is by tracing various behavioral patterns of 20th century Americans back to distinct regions of Britain. The Northeast got the urbane, morally straight, literate East Anglians, while Appalachia was dominated by the wild and woolly Scots-Irish. Centuries later, we can still see the influence of the East Anglians in Massachusetts, the state with the most college graduates, and of the Scots-Irish in TV shows like Cops. It's worth asking, therefore, what cultures is America importing today at a rate of more than 1 million people a year? Academics, popular culture, Democratic senators, and Melissa Harris Perry fill our brains with apocryphal tales of predatory white males in fraternities and the military, while carefully concealing the evidence that women have the least to fear from white Anglo-Saxon men. As Olatokunbo Olukimi warned, with perfect lucidity, about powerful, privileged, straight white men in an article in the Columbia Journal of Gender and the Law that is absolutely not a joke, a group in the dominant role in terms of gender, race, and sexuality will encode, decode an occurrence in a manner consistent with its own privileged position and view of reality, and thus in a manner different from a marginalized group. Due to the hegemony created by the dominant group, the marginalized group may also ascribe to the manner in which the powerful group codes, resulting in false consciousness. On the other hand, all the gang rapes keep being committed by immigrants. With the media actively covering up the crimes of immigrants, it may take a while to notice, but Anglo-American men were the best women ever had it. Feminists see women as a community apart from men, but the truth is, America is a nation apart from the rest of the world. In no area is that clearer than the treatment of women and children. Latin Americans, Arabs, Asians, and Indians take a distinctly less respectful view of the gentler sex. Even continental Europeans can't compete with American men. They don't have the gusto for gang rape, incest, and child rape of our main immigrant groups, but they fall far short of what the English-speaking world considers gallant behavior. It's as if Ted Bundy designed our immigration policies to ensure that the most misogynist cultures go to the head of the line. American employers get the cheap labor, Democrats get the votes, and American girls get the rapes. This would be blindingly obvious, except that the media refused to report anything but good news about immigrants. Suspect described as man. Here's a typical headline from a local Nashville TV station in 2011 about an illegal alien child rapist. Man wanted for raping girl, 11, robbing her family. The story never used the word immigrant, but rather described the suspects as man, a 26-year-old man, the man, and the pair. One of them had, quote, recently been living at the Claremont Apartments on Patricia Drive. A Claremont Apartments man, then. The men were suspected in a rash of armed home invasions, during which they also sometimes raped the occupants, including children. Careful newsreaders would notice that the police had to deploy Spanish-speaking officers on the case, and also that the names of the suspects were Olben Sabier Uceda and Benson Olman Uceda. Only after the first 41 indictments were handed up against Sabier Uceda 2 years later did the city paper, Nashville, Tennessee, finally cough up the information that he was a suspected illegal immigrant. Why only suspected? Doesn't anyone know? Sabier Uceda had been captured at a bus station headed to Mexico. I wonder if flight is a problem with criminal suspects who are citizens of another country. Another, quote, man in the news was Milton Mateo Garcia, just the sort of hard-working immigrant we keep hearing so much about from Marco Rubio and the New York Times. Garcia had 3 jobs. Even after he was caught sneaking into the country illegally from Honduras in 2013, he wasn't discouraged. Through sheer pluck and determination, Garcia came right back and began working as a dishwasher. You just can't get Americans to wash dishes. They won't do it at any price. After less than a year back in the United States, Garcia grabbed a 26-year-old doctor walking to her apartment in the well-to-do Rittenhouse Square area of Philadelphia, forced her into her apartment, and repeatedly raped her. He left with her keys, so when he realized he'd forgotten his bag, Garcia simply let himself back into the woman's apartment, raped her again, collected his things, and left. Suggesting why there's no Honduran Silicon Valley, Garcia also took his victim's cell phone. The cops found him by calling it. Here are the newspaper headlines about this illegal alien's rape of a female doctor. Man allegedly forced Philadelphia doctor into her apartment and raped her. UPI. Man charged with Rittenhouse doctor's rape. NBC10.com. Kitchen worker arrested in Rittenhouse rape. Philadelphia Daily News. Even news stories about immigrant crimes that mention deportation proceedings get headlines like this one. Holly Springs man faces child sex charge. The defendant in that case, Oscar Sanchez Lopez, was no more a Holly Springs man than a burglar at the mayor's residence is a Gracie Mansion man. Lopez was a Mexican man who raped a child in a country where he had no legal right to be. Secret decoder ring for immigrant crimes. It's great living in America and having to interpret news stories as if we're reading Pravda. Usually, the only way to tell if a crime story involves an immigrant is if, 1. The crime involves a uniquely perverse sexual assault, such as gang rape, child rape, or incest. 2. The rapist is shocked that anyone thinks he did something wrong. 3. A woman is involved in the rape or the cover-up. 4. The rapist's name would not be found in a phone book from the 1960s. And 5. Newspapers informatively refer to the rapist in their headlines as man. But those telltale signs allow only an educated guess that the perpetrator is an immigrant. To confirm it, one must search for words such as ice or translator. In a way, we're lucky immigrants don't bother learning English, or the translator search wouldn't work. They were unsure of his immigration status. A case out of Seattle had all the main ingredients of an immigrant crime story. First, the crime consisted of the repeated rapes of five little girls between the ages of 4 and 10. Second, the rapist's lack of remorse led to gasps in the courtroom. Third, the rapes went on for at least 4 years without the intervention of the victim's mother, even though the rapist was her boyfriend. Fourth, the rapist's name was Salvador Alemán Cruz. And finally, the Seattle Times, the only newspaper to cover the case, headlined the article on his conviction: "Man convicted on 7 counts in child rape case." While not the gripping page-turner of a stripper falsely accusing Duke lacrosse players of rape, the Cruz case did have some newsworthy aspects. A 21-year-old girl whom Cruz had begun raping when she was 4 years old went to the top of the courthouse and threatened to jump, rather than face him in court, where he was acting as his own lawyer in order to taunt and intimidate his victims. She was excused from testifying, which wasn't a problem since there were so many other victims. There are exactly 6 news stories on Cruz's case in the entire Nexus archives, all from the Seattle Times, plus an Associated Press report that no newspaper seems to have picked up. The only clue about Cruz's immigration status was this from the Seattle Times. After the assault, Cruz fled to Mexico, prosecutors said. They were unsure of his immigration status. They were unsure of his immigration status? Did anyone ask? In the case of a blindingly false allegation of rape against Duke lacrosse players, reporters pursued details about the accused men like starved bloodhounds. We were told the men's grades, their classes, their professors' impressions of them, the value of their parents' homes, their private emails, their every encounter with the police, and on and on. But a child rapist named Salvador Alemán Cruz needs a Spanish translator in court and flees to Mexico after raping at least 5 little girls, and both the government and media say, "Oh yeah, we don't know his immigration status. Why do you ask?" People who want cheap maids will tell you, "Of course Salvador Alemán Cruz isn't the kind of immigrant we want to legalize." But what are they doing to stop it? They're happy to take the cheap labor and never trouble themselves with figuring out how to keep the Salvador Alemán Cruzes out. Another hardworking illegal immigrant from Mexico is Palemon Vargas Reyes. He would already be a legal resident, on his way to citizenship, if the American public hadn't stopped House Speaker John Boehner from taking up Marco Rubio's comprehensive immigration reform. The media learned their lesson. Henceforth, they will not inform us when Congress is considering an amnesty bill. Reyes owned a construction business. He's a married father of 5. In April 2014, about a year after the U.S. Senate passed Rubio's bill, Reyes was arrested for serially raping a 14-year-old girl. One of the rapes took place at a job site, so he really is a hard worker. The headline on this story was, "Columbus resident charged with molestation." One for the Not Our Problem file. The defendant in a story the Chattanooga Times Free Press headlined, "Smuggling case nets 15-year sentence," was Man, as he was called in another Free Press headline, 36-year-old Herman Rolando Vicente Sapon, an illegal alien from Guatemala. He had persuaded his 16-year-old first cousin, Uria Vicente Calel, to join him in the United States, where he immediately began raping her, got her pregnant, and then began sexually abusing their infant daughter. So the good news is, they have an anchor baby. What are the odds that an American woman could be held as a sex slave by her cousin in a foreign country without her parents ever mentioning anything? But Uria continued to be raped by Vicente Sapon for 5 years with no complaint from her parents. And now, with Uria's incest anchor baby, they can come to the United States and get free health care, food stamps, and Social Security. You don't want to break up families, do you? If you were wondering how an illegal alien was able to rape his cousin for 5 years before finally catching the eye of our immigration officials, the answer is, lots of people who are subsidized by the taxpayer conspired to bring them to this country and turn them into public charges. In order to get Urrea across the border to be his sex slave, Vicente Sapon had hired human smugglers suggested to him by a tax-exempt Hispanic church in East Ridge, Tennessee. He's a churchgoer. After he began sexually abusing his anchor baby, infant daughter, publicly supported lawyers helped Urrea obtain a restraining order against him. Government officials with the Hamilton County Department of Children's Services issued the order, but none of them contacted immigration authorities. They didn't notice that neither Urrea nor her pedophile cousin spoke English? Throughout Vicente Sapon's criminal proceedings and appeals, American taxpayers paid for Spanish translators, child services employees, investigators, judges' salaries, court costs, and so on. Now taxpayers will be on the hook for his room and board in a state penitentiary. All this for a case that should have gone in a file labeled, "Not Our Problem." We have our own underclass that needs help. We don't need other countries' underclasses moving in, too. The Chattanooga Free Press's story on Vicente Sapon's conviction was headlined, "Illegal Alien Arrested for Incest, Child Rape, Kidnapping, and Sex Slavery." Just kidding. It was man, guilty in case of human smuggling. Oh, it was a man! How fascinating! The Free Press never mentioned that the human smuggler was an illegal alien. That information was available only in the federal district court opinion, dismissing Vicente Sapon's motion to exclude his statements to the police, on the grounds that the Spanish translator misunderstood him. But at least the Free Press reported the story. According to Nexus, it was the only news outlet to do so. Another advantage of not speaking English. Vicente Sapon wasn't the first immigrant criminal to game the system by claiming translation problems. In 2010, Annie Ling, a child-abusing Malaysian immigrant, got a new trial, thanks American Civil Liberties Union, after the Georgia Supreme Court held that criminal defendants who allege, after trial, that they are deficient in English are entitled to new trials with taxpayer-provided certified translators. In Annie's case, in Mandarin. In 2011, the Arkansas Supreme Court overturned Jose Luis Mendez's 60-year sentence for rape and attempted murder on the grounds that the Spanish translator misunderstood his confession. This was despite the fact that the victim personally knew Mendez and testified in court that she had awoken to see Mendez on top of her, strangling her, and that the doctor who examined her immediately after the attack testified that her injuries showed she had been strangled, beaten, and raped. Even when police present the defendant with a tape recording and written document giving Miranda warnings in Spanish, that won't prevent an appeal based on translation problems. That's how Guillermo Paniagua Paniagua appealed his conviction for driving drunk on the wrong side of the road, running headlong into the chief of police of Needville, Texas, killing him, then fleeing the accident on foot. So it's kind of relevant when the defendant is an immigrant. Taxpayers are footing the bill for all those translators, as well as the appeals denouncing the translators. With the amount of money an immigration moratorium would save U.S. taxpayers on court interpreters alone, we could build 3 border fences and revive NASA. But when it comes to immigrant criminals, all the media notices that the perp is a man. There seems to be some interest in immigrant child rapists. With the media aggressively hiding information about immigrant crime, citizens take to the internet to document the legions of Americans murdered, maimed, and raped by immigrants. In 2012, Malaysian immigrant Dwipin Thomas Maliakal was arrested after going to a meeting with an undercover cop who had posted on an incest chat room as a father offering up his 10 and 13-year-old daughters for sex. Maliakal, posting under the name Horny Indian, had told the undercover dad that he would, quote, love to get the 10-year-old pregnant if you're okay with that. He detailed various sex practices he wanted to perform on the girls, which the Orlando Sentinel decorously refused to print. He also admitted to having already had sex with other children, including a 5-year-old neighbor. Horny Indian was convicted and sentenced to prison for 14 years. On the website Libertarian Republican, Eric Dondero posted a story about Horny Indian, howling about the silence from the American media. He wrote, "A mystery. The distinguished and hugely popular worldwide London Daily Mail has a feature story on alleged child rapist Dwippin Thomas Malacal, yet no national media in the U.S. has deemed it newsworthy. Only local coverage in the Orlando Sentinel and Tampa Bay Tribune. Is it because it doesn't quite fit the template? The alleged perpetrator is a South Asian from an immigrant family. He is the immediate past president of his college fraternity. He went to a college, University of South Florida, notorious for hard left politics, multiculturalism, and vicious Republican bashing. Malacal was an aspiring journalist and a Bob Costa wannabe sportscaster, minority, went to the right school, good chosen career path. He was a walking, talking poster boy for the liberal media. But it turns out he is also an alleged child molester." The comment section was boiling with rage, except for one commenter who made the important point that Dondero was a racist for noticing that the child molester was an immigrant. Apparently, every time a Muslim gets charged with a sex offense, it's supposed to be national news, because Eric is a racist coward. That a man had admitted to having sex with a 5-year-old could wait. The important point was that it was racist to notice that a sexual predator against American children was an immigrant. Dondero hadn't mentioned that the pedophile was a Muslim, but that's good to know if I'm ever on Jeopardy and the category is immigrant child rapist. If it bleeds, it leads, unless the perp is an immigrant. Stories like this are never broken by the mainstream media. It's always some right-wing blog that publicizes immigrant crimes. Journalists love to claim they only print what the public wants to know. But for as long as there has been news, people have been interested in crime stories. That's why we have the cliché, if it bleeds, it leads. Quite obviously, there's an enormous interest in stories about immigrant crime. But no amount of the public wanting to know will end the media blockade on negative information about immigrants. Jorge Juarez Lopez, an illegal immigrant from Mexico, began raping his illegal alien girlfriend's illegal alien daughters, ages 11 and 13, or possibly 9 and 11, on a drive from Sacramento, California to North Carolina. He continued raping the girls over the next couple of years while living with them as their father. At first, Juarez Lopez would wait for their mother to leave for work and sneak up on the girls saying, "I have a surprise for you." But soon he was forcing the girls to perform oral sex on him even when mom was home, as he watched for her to come up the stairs. When Juarez was caught, he shrugged and told the police, in Spanish, of course, "I belong to the government now." A thrill, I'm sure, for North Carolina taxpayers. Showing little anguish for what he had done, Juarez kept writing to the girl's mother from prison, asking her to weigh how we have lived, everything I've given you. In addition to supporting Juarez in prison for the next 36 to 53 years, taxpayers will be the one giving things to the mother now. She also doesn't speak English. All this so that the farming and meatpacking industries in North Carolina can refuse to mechanize their operations for a few more years, and the Democrats have a shot at turning the state blue. Although he made quite a splash on the internet websites covering illegal alien crime, Juarez Lopez appears in only one document on Nexus, Indie Week, an alternative newspaper out of Durham covering mostly music and culture. Yes, the same newspapers that had blanketed the state with daily updates about a non-existent rape by the Duke lacrosse team had no interest in a real child rape going on for years right under their noses. Even when an illegal alien child molester is arrested in an exciting caper just a block from the New York Times building, they won't report it. In 2012, illegal alien Ricardo Martinez Gomez, who had already been deported 3 times, reappeared in Granville, New York, and sexually molested an 8-year-old girl at a sleepover with his girlfriend's daughter. The little girl reported the abuse to Martinez Gomez's girlfriend, but she told no one, giving her boyfriend time to escape. By the time the victim told her mother, and she contacted the police, Martinez Gomez was on a bus from Albany to New York City. Notified by the Granville police to be on the lookout, Penn Station police were waiting for Martinez Gomez's bus, but he somehow slipped past them. As the cops headed back to an office to review videotapes of the departing passengers, Detective Warren Davis happened to be walking through the station on his lunch break and spotted the accused child molester. Officer Davis asked Martinez Gomez for identification, saw Gerardo Cruz on the man's Social Security card, and recognizing it as the suspect's alias, arrested him. If Martinez Gomez had made it out of Penn Station and strolled one block south, he might have walked right into the New York Times building. The Times would have given him sanctuary, called in La Raza attorneys, and never written a word about the case, unless it was to describe Martinez Gomez as a hard-working immigrant with a shy smile. Only one news outlet wrote about the illegal alien child molester's arrest within shouting distance of the New York Times building, Manchester newspapers. It's not even clear if the story ran in any of Manchester's actual newspapers or just online. When Martinez Gomez was sentenced, only the Schenectady Daily Gazette reported it in a small news blotter item. Flimsy rape accusations against college athletes will be pursued to the ends of the earth. But as soon as a rape suspect is determined to be an immigrant, all news interest vanishes. On August 22, 2014, a local Milwaukee TV station posted a short item. Illinois fugitive is one of Wisconsin's most wanted. He's Armando Romero Gutierrez. Armando was a 36-year-old Mexican wanted for sexually assaulting an 11-year-old family member. U.S. Marshals believed he was either with a brother in Wisconsin or back in Mexico. But then the media trail goes cold. It's been almost a year. Have they found Armando? It might be worth paying more for your yard work. Then there was the child rape case, illustrating the perils of cheap lawn care.